This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. It's officially spring, which means farmers and gardeners are gearing up for planting. From weather concerns to new pest and disease pressures, there's a lot on growers' minds heading into summer. Today, we'll take a look ahead at the growing season with Caitlin Lance, agriculture educator for University of Wisconsin Extension in La Crosse County, and Jessica Leone, a certified master gardener from La Crosse. All right, and Caitlin, I wonder if you could start by talking about how long until we can expect farmers to start getting out into the fields.
We might have noticed some people starting to get out and applying manure. It depends on their nutrient management plan and where their farms are located. So they might already be prepping to get out into the fields. Now, they might be waiting another couple of weeks, though, dependent on weather, because as I saw in the forecast, it unfortunately looks like there might be some snow. So anytime the weather is nice, you're probably going to start seeing farmers more out and about just prepping for the new season. It's usually, though, about that mid-May period that they start planting.
Yeah, so last year we saw kind of an April snowstorm similar to this year's situation. And I wonder kind of what takeaways we can take from last year into, you know, kind of what we can expect for impacts on this year's growing season.
Well, if we have a snowstorm, kind of how we had late into the season. Now, luckily with this snowstorm, it's kind of coming mid-April. So it might have not as big of an impact as it does with what happened last year. So the ground was probably too saturated and we kind of had a wet spring. And so it took farmers a little bit to get out into the fields, which also means can be a little bit later in production or maybe not get quite as good of a quality of a product. It'll just kind of have to be a wait and see with our weather. Hopefully it dries out after the snow goes and they can get out there as soon as possible.
I wonder if you've heard from any producers about impacts of spring flooding this year.
I haven't heard from anybody in particular, but I know it can have a huge impact. Considering we're kind of in that driftless area and we do have farmers on the bluffs, so a lot of erosion issues can be a huge issue, especially, you know, with the Mississippi flooding and things like that. It might take them a little bit longer to get out into the field, so maybe they have to plan a little bit more in advance, you know, maybe looking for seed that will germinate a little bit faster than others. And so it might be a chance, you know, there could be weed pressure and other things like that. So it depends on how saturated that soil is when they can get in.
Jessica, we'll turn to you. I wonder if you could kind of share where we're at in kind of gardeners maybe gearing up for getting into their gardens and how this maybe compares to the typical spring timeline.
Well, I know a lot of the home gardeners have already started their seedlings indoors, those longer germinating seeds. I know I have mine set aside. I have zero plans to put them out until probably mid-May, though. I took them out yesterday to let them see the sun, the actual sun, for a little while. But it'll be a long time before we get out into the gardens to actually put plants in the garden. I know a lot of gardeners, referring to your question about the wetness of the soil, the ones living closer to the Mississippi I've spoken with and have said they're seeing some impact in the sandier soils as far as trying to even step into their gardens without sinking into quicksand. I think a lot of gardeners are just focused on spring cleaning right now, getting out some of the old to put in the new.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about what that might look like, that spring cleaning?
Take out any old plants, any old debris, any extra refuse left over from the fall. We all try and clean up in the fall and get all of that out of the way, but some of us are less successful than others, me being a guilty party. Try and get a feel for what weeds are trying to creep in already and get those while they're young. I was speaking with Caitlin on the way in, the quack grass and the creeping Charlie already trying to make its way into my garden beds. And I prefer not to use herbicides, so it's all pull by hand. And the sooner you can get it, the better.
As far as the moisture of the soil, do you feel like it's kind of typical to see a lot of moisture in the soil at this point in the year, or is it maybe due to the fact that we have seen pretty, you know, minor to moderate flooding in a lot of places?
In my experience, this time of year is just a wet and soggy time of year. Whether there's extra rain or snow, or it's just the snow melt from the previous season, I have yet to step into the garden this time of year without sinking in just a little bit.
I know we've seen the state's National Ag Statistics Service office has put out some numbers on kind of what farmers are planning to plant this year. And I know we're seeing kind of an increase in corn acres and fewer acres of soybeans compared to last year. I wonder, Kaylin, if you can maybe explain maybe some of the factors farmers are taking into account when it comes to, you know, what they're choosing to plant.
Well, and actually, we saw an increase in soybeans last year, so it might just be in their rotation to have corn this year as part of their crop rotation. So that's probably why we're seeing an increase this year in corn. And there might be a little bit higher pricing for corn, especially if we have a lot of winter kill for alfalfa, which means farmers are, for their livestock are going to have to look at alternatives to feed their animals, especially we kind of had a hard time with getting hay this winter, and so it's maybe supplementing with corn silage. So that could be an increase of why they're looking to corn, is to maybe get a little bit better of a price. But my suspect is it's because that's kind of where they're at in the rotation. Since we had such a high influx of soybeans last year, this year we'll see a high influx of corn.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit more about the possibility of winter kill of alfalfa? And, you know, I know that that was definitely a big concern when we saw those extremely cold temperatures, and that can have a big impact.
It can have a huge impact, and especially, too, if we have a really cold and wet spring. Luckily, we've had a few kind of nice days, so things are drying out a little bit. But, yeah, with that alfalfa winter kill, if farmers had enough snow cover when we had that cold snap, their alfalfa plants probably did pretty good with survival, but if there wasn't enough heavy snow cover, they might see a significant amount more of winter kill.
How does the La Crosse area kind of compare to the rest of the state when it comes to, you know, growing row crops like corn and soybeans?
Well, you might see some more kind of unique ways of farming, especially being more environmentally conscious, considering, you know, we have a very unique kind of soil profile with being in the driftless area. You'll see that between La Crosse, Monroe, and Vernon counties. We have, you know, very similar styles, especially with, you know, being on the bluffs. You have to kind of think about, well, how are you planting and what are you planting in your crop rotation to kind of help prevent a lot of that erosion and runoff issues.
Jessica, I wonder if that's also a concern for some gardeners in the area of just, you know, how our topography maybe impacts the way gardeners are laying out their plots.
I think our topography has a real impact on our local gardeners. You have people who are trying to garden on slopes and they have to build retaining walls and such, and think about what they're going to plant on those slopes to try and retain what soil they have. We also have an interesting combination. Certain areas have very sandy soil, as I mentioned earlier. Higher up on the bluffs, you have really heavy clay soil. So it's a really a mixed bag of soils and topographies that you'll be dealing with here in the driftless region.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're taking a look at this year's growing season, when farmers and gardeners are likely to start planting, and what challenges lie ahead. We're here with Jessica Leone, a master gardener in La Crosse, and UW Extension educator Caitlin Lance. You know, Jessica, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, you know, who, as a master gardener, who are the people that are most often reaching out to you? You know, who are the people who are maybe most often gardening in La Crosse?
There's really a mixed bag of gardeners as well, which is really exciting to see. I personally will be working with a 4-H group in May to introduce a whole new group of young gardeners, taking them to the Cane Street Garden, introducing them to our local gardening practices, and explaining to them the joys of growing their own fruits and vegetables. There's also a lot of retirees who love their flower gardens and their vegetable gardens and their canning. So there's really a whole spread of gardeners.
Yeah, I feel like you mentioned retirees, and I think that that is often associated with, you know, spending time in the garden. And so I'm curious if you have the sense that we're seeing younger generations invest as much into gardening as we know that older generations have.
I think I've seen a resurgence in younger populations and an interest in gardening. In addition, not only in the flower gardens, but also in the vegetable gardens and what they can do with that. I think that with a movement to a more organic diet and more of a concern about where their food they're coming from and shopping locally, that, yeah, there's definitely a focus going to younger generations.
Caitlin, I wonder what your thoughts are on this issue of, you know, are we seeing younger generations investing as much into home gardening?
We actually had quite a few younger members in my first class, you know, teaching here in La Crosse County that joined, that wanted to become master gardeners. So that was pretty neat. And we're seeing a lot more people reach out, both younger and older generations, that they are very fascinated where their food comes from. We have a lot of different local groups that work with younger students, too, that are involved with horticulture, not just the master gardener program. So it's really neat to see how passionate the youth are really getting about, well, where does my food come from?
And so, you know, if you have someone who's new to gardening and or maybe feels like they have some bad gardening experiences or kind of cursed with a black thumb, if you will, I mean, what sort of resources exist in our local community that, you know, people can access when it comes to gardening?
Well, especially if they don't have really the area to garden, they can volunteer at the Cane Street Gardens, and they'll put people to work there. They always love new volunteers. Otherwise, if they're interested in maybe seeing plants from around different countries, we have the Riverside International Friendship Gardens. And so those represent seven different sister cities around the world that La Crosse links up to. So it's really neat being able to see those different ways. And if they have an interest in native gardens, we have the Myrick Eco Park. So they're doing a lot of work with restoring native plants that are native to La Crosse County. So it's very unique that way. And honestly, if you are starting a garden, just start small. Think big, but start small. Even if it's just a small container on your backyard porch. You know, there's many different ways of getting involved, throughout the community.
Jessica, what advice do you give to beginning gardeners and maybe examples of kind of accessible plants to start gardening with?
I personally started with vegetable gardening. I think they're very forgiving plants on the whole. As far as my kids that I'm going to be starting this next month, I'm going to be starting them with peas, sugar snap peas, quick, easy growers. Very forgiving, and kids get to enjoy the rewards right away because they are such fast growers. Start small. I agree with Caitlin 100%. Start small and be forgiving of the plants and yourself because there's going to be a learning curve.
I wonder, Jessica, what pest or disease pressures are common in the La Crosse area, and if we've seen any new pest or disease pressures coming into this area.
I did notice that we seem to have a few more stink bugs this year. Caitlin and I were talking about that earlier. My cats, to their dismay, discovered them. I personally am already preparing for the Japanese beetles. They're a constant pressure. I like to bait and trap them personally instead of putting the poison directly on the plants. But those are my main battles right now.
Yeah, and Caitlin, I wonder what experiences you've heard about pest and disease pressures, and especially from farmers.
And we actually just had a workshop for farmers in the area to learn about water hemp. Now, this is pretty obnoxious weed. We don't have a lot of it here, but it is something that can become part of the problem, especially if, you know, people are doing an integrated pest management plan. It's important that if they are using pesticides that they're switching up what pesticides that they use, because a lot of these weeds, and this can even go for home gardeners as well, they can become resistant to that type of pesticide, and then that's just creating stronger and stronger weeds. So the key to that is if something works one year, switch it up to the next year to something else, just so that way that weed isn't becoming tolerant to or resistant to that certain type of pesticide. As far as home gardeners too, and this might go for any fruit producers, we do have the brown marmated stink bug that has been seen in La Crosse County. This can affect vegetative plants and fruit trees. It's not anything to really panic about right now, but just kind of be on the aware. Like Jessica said, you know, she's noticed a few more stink bugs and, you know, Japanese beetles. We might see, it depends on the weather, will really depend on what kind of weed and pest pressure we really have on the farms. So if we have a lot drier weather, we might see, you know, more aphids or things like that. If it's a little wet, we might see, you know, other different types of pests.
I know last year there was quite a bit of mold issues because we had a pretty moist kind of fall season. And so I wonder if that's also something farmers are maybe preparing for this year.
Yeah. So, I mean, there was a lot of different molds, and this goes from farmers to homeowners. I got so many calls last year from homeowners with their trees, like their leaves falling off, and they're like, there's all these kind of spots on them. And I'm like, unfortunately, it's a type of fungus, and there's not much you can do except for kind of clean up in the fall because it could be gone the next year. Just because certain types of funguses and different types of molds, those in corn and soybeans, they really do depend on that wet weather. So if we have a drier season, we may not have to deal with those same types of you know, molds and funguses. But, I mean, that's something we definitely need to be aware of, both farmer and gardener.
Jessica, I saw you shaking your head when I brought up mold. I mean, is this something you struggled with last year?
Absolutely. To the dusty mildew, I lost most of my squash crops and cucumber crops pretty early on. It's always a struggle in a dry year or a wet year against certain kinds of molds, but particularly the dusty mildew. But it was especially bad last year, and I lost a lot of things early on that I would have hoped would have survived till later in the year. And our apple trees were dropping leaves like crazy from the mildews and the molds that were growing on them.
I mean, is there anything that you know, people can do to try to protect their gardens from these issues?
I guess it's just kind of being aware of your soil content, you know, and this kind of goes for anybody that's, you know, first starting off in farming or gardening. It's super important to know what type of soil you have. So if you have more clay, you know, it's going to maintain that moisture a lot. So maybe looking for plants and stuff that can maintain a lot of moisture and aren't affected then so much about having a high moisture content. On the same end, once it dries out, it also has to be forgiving of kind of that almost clay baking. With sandier soils, that water does just go straight through. But if we get a lot of flooding events like we did, I mean, it can almost turn into quicksand dependent on what's underneath the sand. And so it's just, yeah, kind of being aware of, you know, what type of soil you have. There are some herbicides and stuff that you can, you know, fungicides, I should say, that you can spray, but, you know, once you have to figure out what type of fungus it is that you're dealing with, because one type of fungicide isn't going to cure all. But you can find plants, too, that are resistant. Now, that doesn't mean they're immune, but you can find plants that are resistant to some of these funguses as well.
We know that we're already seeing the effects of a changing climate in our state. And I wonder, Caitlin, if you know, those impacts of more frequent and more severe storms, like how those are impacting area farmers and are likely to impact area farmers this year too.
Well, if we have another flood event like we did last August into September, I mean, we had farmers who lost whole fields. Like, that corn just became lodged. It wasn't able to be, you know, we had a lot of mold issues, and then that can lead to bacteria, so then it's not edible then by animals. And so if we keep having things like that, then farmers need to really think about, well, where are they planting? And it can have a huge economic impact, and in a low commodity price time, I mean, that can put a lot of stress on various farmers.
Yeah, I mean, how are farmers coping in this area with the low commodity prices that we've seen for a number of years now?
Well, some farmers are kind of turning to diversifying their farms. So instead of just relying on one single, you know, commodity, they're looking at adding others. So whether they're, you know, doing beef and crops, another thing that some Wisconsin farmers are looking at doing is adding industrial hemp as a, you know, another crop that they can grow. I've had lots of phone calls about, you know, well, how can I get involved with industrial hemp? So I'll be, you know, hopefully helping out with some research this summer to learn more myself and, you know, assist those farmers that next year want to apply to be a part of that process.
Yeah, do you feel like we have enough research and information on how to grow hemp in our state for that crop to really be successful at this point?
The way I'm looking at it is it's kind of a huge learning curve at first, and it's really about knowing who your processor is and your market. So if you have a market for it and you have a processor, then you're kind of set up. But we don't have a lot of processors in the state yet, so it's going to be something that's going to be a little slow at first, which is why I think, you know, not a lot of people, you know, in the second year have applied to do the industrial hemp. And so it'll be interesting to see what research is coming out. And that's the one thing I love about UW-Madison is they are always, you know, looking for that next step and, you know, what kind of profit margin are we going to get with this type of crop. And hemp has been grown in Wisconsin before. So it'll be interesting to see how it does, you know, compared to when it was grown.
Jessica, I want to ask you about how you feel the effects of a changing climate are impacting home gardeners. I mean, have you seen any impacts?
I've seen the impact from season to, you know, the seasonal changes as far as when our snowstorms are coming through. It's a little more unpredictable now. I know some people were May 1st, they were putting things out, and now we're going to hold off till May 15th, or, you know, we're going to wait a little bit longer to trust that the season has actually changed. And the moisture levels, hopefully, it's just a temporary change, because it especially those of us with clay soils, it's difficult to find a plant that will forgive that much moisture.
Yeah, and with that kind of shifting more into the summer months for planting, and I wonder, is that shortening the growing season, or is it just shifting it?
I think personally for my garden, it's been shortening it. I'm not getting the quality growth just because we're not getting as much sunlight later in the season as I'd like to see in the late fall. The spring, you know, all my plants are wanting to wake up now. The sunshine's there. It's kind of warm, but it's not safe to put those more delicate young plants out yet. They just can't survive if the weather turns on us.
And Caitlin, very briefly as we wrap up here, what do you think are going to be the biggest challenges for growers this year?
I think in general is, you know, with unpredictable weather. It's just kind of being aware of, you know, these pest pressures and weed pressures, and yeah, maybe a shortening growing season. So, I mean, that can be a huge impact. But yeah, I think we'll see some, especially when it comes to farmers, some, you know, more increase in some of those pests and weeds as some of them become more resistant.
Caitlin Lance, agriculture educator for UW Extension in La Crosse County, and Jessica Leone, certified master gardener, are here with us today to talk about this year's growing season, what challenges lie ahead for farmers and gardeners, and where people can access resources to help. Coming up, we'll take a look at the role of community gardens in the La Crosse area and how they're growing fresh produce and relationships among residents. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website, WPR.org/newsmakers. Our site has archives of other past editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll find links to our producers and staff. That and more at WPR.org/newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Hope Kerwin. Some residents of the La Crosse area may be itching to get into their home gardens, but others don't have access to garden space, resources, or knowledge to grow their own fresh foods. Today we're talking about two organizations working to provide fresh, locally grown produce to children and neighborhoods through community gardens. We're here with Todd Huffman, garden coordinator for the Cane Street Community Garden, and Jamie O'Neill, executive director of Grow La Crosse, a nonprofit that supports a network of local school gardens. Todd, I wonder if you could start by talking a little bit about what community gardening looks like in the La Crosse area, because I know we have a number of organizations kind of working in this area.
Right. Well, our Cane Street Community Garden is organized as an all-together garden. So we have about an acre and a half there on the north side, and that's land we're renting from the city. And so you would come there and work together to grow the garden. There's no separate plots. I know there is other gardens in Holman and Washburn Garden, you would maybe get your own plot. But ours is organized where we do it all together as a community.
Yeah, and Jamie, I mean, it sounds like there are a lot of different ways to go about community gardening. And I know your organization does it through schools.
Yes, we currently serve 6 elementary schools around the La Crosse area. So that's 4 elementary schools in La Crosse and then 2 just outside of La Crosse in La Crescent and Coon Valley. And we both help the schools maintain the garden because, as you said, sometimes that can be hard with gardens. And then we also do school garden education with the classes at the schools that we're in.
How do you feel like all of these different community garden programs maybe fit together?
Yeah, they work together really nicely because if a school or if a child is in a school where we run a school garden program, you know, they're able to see maybe a few raised garden beds and different plants. And then they can go over and maybe take a field trip to Cane Street Garden and see things on a larger scale. We also work with Deep Roots Community Farm, and that also allows field trips to let kids see things on a bigger scale. And they also have animals as well. So you're seeing a big part of the food system.
So I want to start by kind of digging into each of your organizations. So Todd, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how the Cane Street Community Garden got started.
Right. That was in 1999. And there was just some visionary people that one of them was Linda Lee from the food, the county director of food programs, and Marilyn Hurt worked for the food system in schools, and Sue Schultz, and they found the site. And then the Hunger Task Force is a hunger group. So we also have a large food bank, which is actually kind of a bigger part of the organization. That group picks up well over 1 million pounds of food that's donated and is delivered to pantries and meal sites. So the two go together really well because our overflow can go to the food bank. And we even could bring food from the food bank out to the garden when we give out food. So we were started just by people that said, let's just turn these 2 blocks into a garden. It's close to 2 acres. And our goal is to raise a lot of food. Like we'll have 600 tomato plants. For instance, we grew over 8,000 pounds of tomatoes 2 years ago. And our goal is to raise 30,000 pounds. and we can do that if we get enough helpers, which we always seem to get a lot of great volunteers. We love the volunteers, and we really couldn't do it without volunteers. I'm there, and there's another part-time opening, and then we need a lot of volunteers, so everyone's invited to come out.
Yeah, I mean, who typically volunteers at the garden?
Well, today there were four or five people that I would say are kind of retired people, and there was also six college students came by. So it's whoever is available. We are daytime. It's eight. We're open Monday through Saturday, 46 hours a week. So it's that sense, you kind of have to be available. But I think the retired people are amazingly available and committed. You don't have to be retired to come, though. But I just so in awe of, you know, how people give of their time. We have people that come 6 days a week. Not very many. So, but you're welcome to come once a week, once a month, one time. I would just say anyone could come by, drop in, and see how it looks, and then come back. Hopefully they want to help. By helping, you're growing. You really can take home some food for yourself and for your community.
Yeah. How is the food distributed?
Well, we give it out on Monday and Thursday at 5 o'clock and Saturday at noon. So we pick just before that three times a week. And we sign in the volunteers when they arrive, and we call the names in order. So whoever volunteered the longest that day will go through first. And we used to, long ago, would say, like, oh, you can have one tomato, and we'd kind of tell them what they could have. But now we just say, you can have whatever you want, and but just maybe look around you and see who else is in line. We might give a guidance, like in August, it could be you can have about 10 pounds, or now we're picking some spinach, and you can maybe have a pound. But we give them a little guidance, but we just ask them to share with their community. And it's worked out pretty good. It's actually worked out better to do it that way than to tell someone exactly how many of each vegetable they can have. And also then the overflow goes back to the warehouse, and that can get delivered to like 92 sites. There actually is 92 different programs that are partners with Hunger Task Force.
So obviously this garden has been around for a long time. And I just wonder, you know, what community need is this filling that people are still, you know, kind of pouring in their efforts to keep this community garden going?
Well, I would say we start as a food group, so we're filling a need to grow the food. Our goal is 30,000 pounds, and that's important. We want it to stay big, and we're planting the whole. I want to plant every square foot, and then if we harvest in June, we'll plant it again. So we're growing real intensively. But I think beyond that, it's your growing. Really, our motto on our flyer says growing together to nourish the community. So really, not just growing the food, but growing as a person, and then growing as a community that you're helping to, helping your neighbor. We have school groups come of all ages. We have, big school groups come. We have some second graders coming next month, and a lot of middle schoolers, high schoolers, college. So, I hope all the young people especially get a message you're doing this to help others. You know, there's a lot of people in our city that probably don't have enough food, and or food is kind of expensive. So by growing the food, you're helping to feed others.
I'm kind of putting you on the spot, but I wonder if there's a particular story of a volunteer or someone who came to get food at the garden who you really feel like embodies that.
Oh, wow, I know we had, I will mention a guy that, he didn't take home a lot of food, but he was a retired physician. A lot of people know him as the Tomato Man, George Fulford, and he unfortunately passed away last year, but he was 76, and he would come 6 days a week. And we have 600 tomato plants, and he wanted to take care of them. He was passionate about sharing his knowledge. He was an expert gardener on tomatoes especially. And we have people like that. And he was really just grasped the goal of feeding other people. But we have a lot of people that, the low-income people, that they come and help. Like, it's not like we're just going to give you the food. We do ask that you work an hour if possible. And we have all sorts of jobs. Like a lot of people maybe can't bend over so much. Well, they could wash the vegetables or weigh them. There's definitely something for everyone.
That's Todd Huffman, Garden Coordinator for the Cane Street Community Garden, here with us today to talk about local programs inspiring La Crosse area residents to get their hands dirty and grow fresh food. He's joined by Jamie O'Neill, Executive Director of Grow La Crosse. You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Jamie, I'll turn to you and kind of have you start by talking a little bit about how Grow La Crosse got started.
Yeah, so we've been around officially for a little over 4 years, but even before that, there was a group of parents that formed to try to figure out how to best encourage their kids to eat healthy once they go into the elementary school. These moms had stayed at home with their kids and felt like they were giving up or losing some control maybe as the kids go into elementary school. And as the birthday parties and things like that started, they just wanted to make sure there was as much positive influence as there was maybe sugar influence. I was not a parent at that time, but had just graduated from UWL in the Community Health Master's Program. And I had come to this looking for a way to help kids eat healthier. I had been working at a boarding school and came to study different initiatives and try to figure out which one was the most effective in getting kids to eat healthier. So I looked at just giving away food. Like for instance, in La Crescent for a bit, they put an apple or an orange on every kid's tray, just thinking, you know, that would increase the kids' fruit intake by at least one, which is helpful. But unfortunately, some of them put it right into the garbage because they felt forced to eat that. And I'm not picking on them. Initiatives we have to try to see how we can get people to eat healthier. But the more research I read, the more it was showing that school garden education was one of the top ways to get kids to eat healthier. So I joined the group about probably 6 or 7 years ago as it was just starting to form, and then we got our 501c3, which means nonprofit status, in 2014. So again, we're on our like four and a half years of officially being Grow, and yeah, now we are at 6 different schools. We built kind of slowly because we wanted to make sure that once we were in a school, we were really getting to know that school, really offering quality program before moving on to another school.
Yeah, so talk a little bit about who is actually tending the garden and the plants that you're growing.
Yeah, so at each school, we help maintain the garden and oversee that maintenance by letting kids maintain it while we're doing some educational programming, and then offering volunteer work days as well. But the education sessions are open to any class at the schools that we're supporting. So anywhere from 4K all the way up to 5th grade in the elementary schools can come out. We also serve Gunderson Child Care, so we do some preschool lessons as well. But any teacher who is interested can come. And last year was, I want to say, our 5th year at State Road Elementary. That was the first school that we started at, and 100% of the teachers signed up for every single lesson because we do make it quite easy for them in terms of preparation. They actually don't have to prepare anything. The teacher can just sign up and come out with their students. So we try to make it as easy as possible so that the teachers can concentrate on their teaching while they're in the classroom and then come out to the garden, and then we help lead those sessions.
What happens with the food that you guys grow?
Yeah, so it actually gets distributed 3 different ways. The first is just during the garden education lessons, we try to have tasting time. So for instance, last year we, or maybe 2 years ago, did an arugula pesto that we made with the kids. And a lot of kids were asking for to pick fourths in the garden of arugula because now they knew what it tasted like. It's kind of cool because it's a little spicier than other lettuce. So they eat some right during their classroom time in the garden. We also do pick extra produce and put it in the garden, or sorry, in the cafeteria salad bar, so kids can eat it through there. And cafeteria staff have said that when they label it from the garden, kids are eating it much faster because they helped plant it, sometimes even harvest it before it went into the cafeteria. In the third place, the food goes is when volunteers come during the summer. So we have family volunteers help maintain the gardens. They can take some produce home after helping with the garden. And then in the summer as well, we do have summer school classes at these sites, and they also utilize that fresh produce.
Why do you think that connection with the garden is encouraging kids to eat more of this produce?
So the research shows that when you're planting and harvesting and learning how to prepare that food, that's breaking down a lot of knowledge barriers. If you were just to read something on how to prepare or plant something, that's much harder to learn than if you're actually in person there learning to do those things. So, for instance, Brussels sprouts. If you've never seen Brussels sprouts grow and all you're seeing it is on your tray or maybe in the grocery store, you may have no clue how to prepare and eat Brussels sprouts. However, if somebody shows you how to cut them in half and roast them with a little olive oil and salt, you're probably much more likely then in the future to know how to prepare those and even use them. So I think garden education really helps break down those barriers from being something unknown to something people are really familiar with.
Todd, I imagine that there is education happening as well at the community garden, maybe among neighbors.
Yeah, definitely. I think of gardening as like you learn by doing. So definitely believe we're teaching every day. Like if we're going to go out and plant the cabbages in the ground, you'll see the way we do it to prepare the soil and plant. And in that way, it's a lesson. We also do have some like more formal lessons. I know starting on April 29th, every Monday and Thursday for 10 classes, there's one of our volunteers has offered to teach classes about permaculture, which is combining like perennial plants in agriculture, the fruit trees and berry bushes and herbs. So that'll be every Monday and Thursday. So we do some of that also.
Why do you think that kind of education is important to have in the community? I'm especially thinking for if someone's coming from a family where they haven't gardened before.
Well, yeah, I think I would like to see everyone grow some food. Like you could have a container in a pot and grow a cherry tomato. That would be your garden. I think it's real important for people to see where their food comes from and to see what you put on your garden and how you produce it. Because in general, I think people probably are pretty got far away from their food. And I would agree with what Jamie said on the Brussels sprouts. It's not a popular vegetable, and if you've never eaten it, then you have an issue there. But by growing it, for sure, you're gonna want to pick it and take it home. And we always kind of kid people, like if even a kid or even an adult, if they plant that cabbage, like, well, you're going to come back and take care of it, right? And they don't have to, but we hope they'll come back and then maybe harvest it. Yeah.
Yeah, Jamie, I wonder how often you get kids who maybe have never grown vegetables before or maybe didn't know how that process works.
Yeah, it's really fun to see them discover things for the first time. I mean, ideally it wouldn't be their first time, but when we do get to see that and the excitement in it, it is really amazing and fun to see them excited about that whole process. And I would agree with Todd that just really connecting them to that local food and their food system can be a first for some of them in the garden.
Jamie, you mentioned that Grow La Crosse started out of this interest in really making sure kids are getting healthy food. And you know, I wonder if you could talk about why community gardening and just this initiative of encouraging gardening is really a public health issue.
Yeah, it really is. Like you were saying, we have become pretty far removed, a lot of us, from our food sources. And so not knowing where our food comes from it makes us more likely not to choose healthy local foods. So the more we can connect back to our food system and learn about our local food system, the more that we are purchasing or growing our own local food. And if people aren't eating their fruits and vegetables, we know that connects to so many, a big array of health issues. So connecting back, eating those fruits and vegetables can really help raise the bar to the health of our community.
Yeah, Todd, I wonder if you have thoughts on this issue of, you know, why gardening is in some ways, you know, related to public health.
Well, for sure, in terms of diet, I mean, we know that, like, I would say organic vegetables and fresh local organic vegetables are about the healthiest thing you can eat. And so in that way, I mean, there's so much food I don't want to insult like other types of food necessarily, but processed food is far removed from local vegetables. So, you know, we want to eat. Everyone needs to eat, and we want to encourage people to eat well. I think that eating vegetables is the basis of good health, and that way, you know, we just have to encourage healthy behavior. It's also great exercise, for one thing, too, to grow a garden. You're out in nature. You get to interact with nature and, you know, meet other people. It's healthy just as a person to be out there in the garden and working with others. So in that way, that's good health there also.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Todd. I was going to piggyback on that a little bit, too. Mm-hmm. We're concentrating this spring and doing our theme of healthy mind, body, and soil because of all those health benefits that you're getting not only just from eating the food, but also from being out there, being out in nature. They find that if kids take a 20-minute break out in nature, so maybe a school garden or community garden, and come back in, they're more calm, they do better on tests, and their whole mental state is improved. So our mental and psychological state is improved. So we really find so many other benefits than just that healthy food aspect when people are out gardening.
Jamie, I wonder if you could share a little bit about how your program is funded.
Yeah, so we are fortunate to have many different businesses, community members, and then even the schools, their parent-teacher organizations help pitch in to what makes our school garden education and that maintenance possible. And then we also do an event every year, which gives us some of our funding as well, and we write grants. So it is coming from a large source of different funding, but we are also very efficient with our funding. We have about 6 part-time staff, and some of those are just seasonal in the summer working on the farm for the farm camps. So we have part-time staff, and each of those works with, again, a few schools or the farm camps. So any funding can really go a long way.
Yeah, and Todd, I'll kind of pose the same question to you about where funding comes from for the community garden.
There's two big programs of the Hunger Task Force of La Crosse. So we're a nonprofit agency that was started in 1999. So our board of directors and our executive director, Shelley Fortner, is taking on the job of raising money for sure. And they do fundraisers and grant writing. So there is, that's kind of behind the scenes. We kind of make it a point to not, we have people walk up and say, can I give you money? And I will always tell them, we're on the website and we're in the white pages. You can donate money. Yes, we would encourage that, but not at the garden, because I don't want people to think they have to give money to get the vegetables. So we are definitely, a nonprofit agency and have been for about 21 years.
What do you think, what are some of the biggest challenges for the community garden ahead? You know, are there concerns about funding or even things like a changing climate?
For sure the fundraising is always, for all small nonprofits, that is an issue. You need to raise money every year. So that is definitely, climate change, I definitely believe climate change is happening. The scientists tell us it is, and I think I notice it with highly variable weather. So it can rain a lot. Last year we had a lot of large rain events, and that really can throw your planting schedule into disarray. And for local organic vegetable farmers, it could really, be financially bad, because once you get off schedule in June or May, then it can affect your whole year. So I feel like we just want to be real quick, like we want to get stuff done every day, and if it's a dry day, we're going to work up the soil and plant something. We plant we have a great partner of WTC Horticulture with a greenhouse. They started planting in early February, and we're going to plant every week until mid-September. we don't just plant once and be done. We're plant. So that we have to just kind of go between the rainstorms like last year, though. It was so rainy. And we do have a real sandy site, so we're a benefit. We can work our soil early. We did plant outside last week. It was dry, and we're sandy. It was dry enough, warm enough, so we planted our root crops.
And Jamie, I wonder very briefly, kind of what are the biggest challenges ahead for your organization?
I would say the same, just in terms of a lot of kids request more garden education. They love to see us even out at recess for open garden time or after school, and we would love to provide more opportunities. But as you said, funding can be tricky for small organizations. And then climate change has also played a factor. This year, after a very icy and then snowy weekend, our hoop house collapsed, unfortunately. So we are in the process of rebuilding that. So weather can definitely be tricky and even shorten or challenge the time we do have to plant.
Jamie O'Neill, Executive Director of Grow La Crosse, and Todd Huffman, Garden Coordinator for the Cane Street Community Garden, joined us in studio today to talk about community garden initiatives in the La Crosse area. And that's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. The executive producer for Newsmakers is John Gatto, and our senior news editor and producer is John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, including our look ahead at this year's growing season with UW Extension and a Master Gardener, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers.